food allergy is a complex, potentially life-threatening condition that requires a multidisciplinary approach, yet confusion persists in distinguishing IgE and non-IgE-mediated reactions from intolerances. At the same time, advances in immunotherapies and biologics are opening new opportunities for proactive, personalized care. Hello, everyone. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University and the host of this three-part mini-series entitled Food Allergy Frontlines, Clarifying Diagnosis, Advancing Treatment from the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. This podcast series is also supported by a grant from Genentech. In this episode, we'll discuss the growing role of biologic therapies like omalizumab in managing complex food allergies, reviewing trial data, mechanisms, and practical guidance for collaborative care. I'm excited to be joined once again by two food allergy experts in the field. Our first expert is Dr. Julie Wang. Dr. Wang is a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at Icahn School of Medicine, Mount Sinai. Dr. Wang's research focuses on clinical trials developing new treatments for food allergies, as well as studies aimed at better understanding how patients and their families manage food allergies and anaphylaxis in schools and other community settings. Welcome back to the podcast, Julie.
Thanks for having me, Jerry.
And our second expert is Dr. Brian Vickery. Dr. Vickery is a professor of pediatrics and chief of the Division of Allergy and Immunology at Emory University and Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. A nationally recognized clinician scientist, his research focuses on improving outcomes for children with food allergies through novel interventions and therapies. He has authored over 125 publications and is a leading voice in advancing the field of pediatric food allergy. Brian, welcome back to the podcast.
Good to be with you, Jerry. Thanks for having me back. Appreciate the invitation.
Okay, let's get started. Julie, let's start with you. In the last episode, we discussed immunotherapy for food allergy, but another treatment option, omalizumab, was recently FDA approved over a year ago for the treatment of IgE-mediated food allergy. Could you give the audience an overview of omalizumab, what it is, how it works, and who is it for?
Sure. So omalizumab is a medication that binds to IgE antibodies and prevents them from attaching to the mast cells. What this results in is a decrease in the release of inflammatory or allergic mediators from mast cells and also leads to a reduction of these IgE receptors on the mast cells themselves. This medication has been available for over 20 years already. It's FDA approved for other allergic disorders such as allergic asthma, chronic hives, and nasal polyps. And food allergy was the newest indication by the FDA last year. So this is not specific to any food allergy and therefore can be used for patients with allergies to one food or multiple food allergies. It's FDA approved for patients with IgE-mediated food allergies who are 1 year old and older.
So Brian, I did a deep dive with you, Dr. Bob Wood, and Dr. Sharon Shinthraja last year on the OutMatch trial on Allergy Talk, but once again, could you review some of the key findings from the OutMatch trial that led to the FDA approval?
Sure, Jerry. The approval of omalizumab for food allergy was based on the stage one outcome of the OutMatch trial, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in February of 2024. Basically, stage one was a straightforward randomized controlled trial of omalizumab monotherapy or placebo in participants aged 1 to 55 years with challenge-proven multiple food allergies. Now, all participants had to be allergic to peanut, and then they also had to be allergic to at least two other non-peanut foods from a short list that included milk, egg, wheat, cashew, hazelnut, or walnut. Now, following the completion of the screening procedures, 177 participants were randomized in a 2-to-1 ratio to omalizumab or placebo dosing, which utilized a modified version of the asthma dosing table. And all participants received these injections for a period of 16 to 20 weeks, at which point they underwent blinded oral food challenges to determine efficacy. The primary endpoint of the study was the proportion of participants in each group able to tolerate at least 600 milligrams of peanut protein without dose-limiting symptoms, which was achieved by 67% of those receiving omalizumab compared to 7% receiving placebo. Similar differences were observed for the other endpoints measuring non-peanut foods, and safety endpoints did not differ between groups with the exception of more injection site reactions reported in the active omalizumab group.
So, Julie, I know that after stage one, there were other stages examining other questions about the role of omalizumab, including comparing it to multi-allergen food oral immunotherapy, as well as introduction of food allergens after treatment. What do we know about the outcomes from the other stages?
Yeah, so the OutMatch trial included three stages and sought to answer many questions related to omalizumab. The first stage, Brian just discussed, and I'll talk to the adding foods into the diet part first of your question. So at the end of stage one, the first 60 participants who finished the randomized placebo-controlled study of omalizumab as monotherapy, those 60 went on to open-label omalizumab for 24 weeks. After that, they were transitioned to eating their allergen using retail food products or foods that could be bought in the supermarket. If they were not able to include a food in their diet in measurable quantities, then they could undergo rescue OIT for that food or opt to continue avoidance of that food. So as a reminder, patients entered the OutMatch study with three study foods, one of which was peanut. The majority of these 60 participants in the open label part at following stage one were able to transition to eating at least one of their three foods after 24 weeks of omalizumab. There was varying success rates with keeping these foods in the diet over the following 12 months. And in general, the most success was seen with those who added milk, egg, and wheat to their diet, and less success for those attempting to add peanut and tree nuts into the diet. Over time, across the board, participants generally ate less of their allergens at the end of the 12 months as opposed to when they first transitioned to eating foods. And this reduction in eating appeared to have multiple reasons. Some decreased their eating because they were having symptoms of the food, while others reduced their eating because of patient preference. Of note, adverse events did occur over the course of eating these foods, but these adverse events did decrease over time. These included a few cases of anaphylaxis reactions, a few reactions that needed treatment with epinephrine, as well as four cases of eosinophilic esophagitis. But overall, most participants were able to add their foods into their diet after being on omalizumab, and many, though, did return to avoiding their allergen. Now, addressing your second question about the multi-allergen oral immunotherapy in comparison to omalizumab, that was the second stage of OutMatch. And this data was presented at this year's QuadAI annual meeting. Those on the active OIT arm did receive a short course of omalizumab starting 2 months before OIT through the first 2 months of updosing. And after that, participants of the OIT arm continued OIT dosing without any more omalizumab. So as a reminder, after that, participants in the OIT arm continued OIT without omalizumab. Now, 88% of participants in the omalizumab group completed stage two of the study as compared to 51% in the multi-OIT group. The primary endpoint for this part of the OutMatch trial was whether they could tolerate about 4 grams of each of the study foods. And what this translates to is 4 grams would be about 17 to 18 peanuts or about half a cup of milk. Now, this primary endpoint was successfully met by 36% of those in the omalizumab group as compared to 19% in the multi-OIT group. This difference was mainly due to the higher rates of adverse events in the OIT group, and 31% in the OIT group had serious adverse events, and overall 22% dropped out of the OIT arm due to adverse events. There was also a higher rate of epinephrine use to treat adverse events in the OIT group.
Okay, well, Julie, thanks for that summary. And I know that at the time of this recording, we're still waiting for the final manuscript to review the data. But as it stands now, for what we know, we now have this new option when we engage in shared decision-making regarding the treatment of food allergy. And we talked about immunotherapy at the LAPS episode. But Brian, now that you have omalizumab to add to the conversation, how do you integrate that when you're doing shared decision-making regarding treatment?
Yeah, thanks, Jerry. This is obviously a really critical issue. The way I approach shared decision-making for any condition or decision is with active listening and an unbiased presentation of options. The process starts by meeting the family or patient where they are in terms of their understanding of their condition and to clarify any areas of uncertainty or misunderstanding. And often there are some things to be addressed before we can start talking about treatments. From there, I ask questions about their priorities and preferences and the goals of treatment should they decide to pursue one, keeping in mind that, number one, goals, priorities, preferences could be different for different foods in a multi-food situation. And also keeping in mind that avoidance diets are still a very reasonable choice for many patients for their one or more food allergens. Now, with the addition of omalizumab, we have a treatment option that is the first to be non-daily. It's the first to be indicated for the treatment of multiple allergies and the first to be approved in adults. And so that broadens the population of patients eligible for treatment compared to what came before and addresses some previously unmet medical need. But in other populations, omalizumab might be considered an alternative to another available approach like immunotherapy, oral sublingual immunotherapy perhaps, or even potentially used as an adjunct to one of these forms of immunotherapy, as they're not mutually exclusive and in fact have been extensively studied in combination. So obviously there are going to be some important factors that influence the way individuals feel about these treatments. For example, one is injectable, one might have another route, one is a monoclonal biologic product, one is more of a natural treatment. The risk of frequent and usually mild but occasionally unpredictable allergic reactions with immunotherapy versus a product that doesn't contain any allergens, lifestyle barriers, oral aversion, and so on. There's lots of things to potentially consider. But when you ask questions and practice active listening, what you find is that different patients and families have different concerns, priorities, and value systems. And so in my mind, a good outcome of the shared decision-making process is to provide them the information they need to make the best choice for them and them only, and to recognize that one size does not fit all.
Hey, Julie, I just want to know, would you add anything in terms of how you counsel patients about integrating omalizumab into their treatment if it's right for them?
Yeah, something that is specifically different about omalizumab as opposed to the allergen-specific immunotherapy such as OIT, EPIT, and SLIT is that omalizumab is already FDA approved for other allergic disorders, including allergic asthma, chronic hives, and chronic sinusitis with nasal polyps. So for a patient who is experiencing multiple of these allergic issues, omalizumab may be a very good single medication to address more multiple disorders at the same time. Also, this medication is approved across the entire age or is approved across the age spectrum from 1 year through adulthood, and we don't see any differences in efficacy or safety across age groups. So this is something that the patients and their families can think about at really any age and choose to start whenever they feel this might be appropriate.
I probably should have made this point earlier, but I think one of the other key differences you have to also think about is really almost from like an access perspective, right? In that if you come to a center like where Julia and I practice, we'll be able to offer these different alternatives. We do immunotherapy and other things, which are treatments that are not available at every place. There's not widespread availability of immunotherapy across the U.S. Whereas omalizumab, being around for 20 years, is a medicine that many allergists have experience using and feel comfortable using, even though they might not offer immunotherapy in their practice. The other part about this is that immunotherapy typically requires a lot of dosing visits. You have to come back to the clinic on a pretty frequent basis and plan to be there for a few hours, which not everybody can do because not everybody can take the time off of work and school to do that. And so omalizumab in this way may make it a little bit more convenient to access treatment because of the different kind of visit schedule. And so that net effect may be that there are opportunities to treat patients from the standpoint of access that wouldn't have had the opportunity to be treated for their food allergy with a typical immunotherapy approach.
Oh, thanks for that, Brian. Wow. You know, I reflect as a practicing allergist over the last 5 to 10 years and how we've just transitioned from mainly avoidance to having all these treatment options so patients can achieve certain outcomes, as you're both saying, according to their preferences and what's right for their situation. But this field continues to surprise me, and I know you both are on the leading edge of this. So I'd love for you to talk about the future. Julie, is there anything in the next 5 years in the pipeline that you are particularly looking forward to in the treatment of food allergy?
Oh, absolutely. There is so much to look forward to and a lot of changes happening in the field of food allergy. In the next several years, I'm hopeful that more forms of immunotherapy will become available as treatment options for my patients. Right now, it's OIT and then omalizumab, as well as the choice to continue avoidance. But these other forms of EPIT and SLIT can be, hopefully, another choice that families will have. There are also other medications that are addressing other parts of the immune system, not just IgE, and that are not allergen specific. And these medications, as examples, are tezepelumab and BTK inhibitors that are in clinical trials for food allergy. So those are other exciting avenues that are being explored. And then in addition, combinations of medications or treatment approaches are being looked at. So there hopefully will be many, many options for our patients and families in the next few years.
How about you, Brian? What are you looking forward to?
Yeah, Julie mentioned a number of exciting new options in late stage development that may become commercially available in the next few years. And there are some also some more experimental kind of early stage approaches in like phase one trials or preclinical studies that are being developed, which are highly innovative, but may not pan out. But regardless, we anticipate that the treatment landscape for food allergies will definitely continue to evolve and become more and more complex. So one thing that I'm also really looking forward to and kind of interested in is the development of capabilities that will allow us to better study these treatments in large numbers of real-world patients so that we can begin to address really critical unknowns about how these treatments work outside of the clinical trial setting. For instance, how well do they protect people from accidental exposures? What does quality of life or important patient-reported outcomes in the real world look like? Or how about long-term adherence over the course of many years, or cost-effectiveness, or how do we define value in the real world? These kinds of things that remain critical gaps in our understanding. And then ultimately, we really need to move forward to try to develop evidence that could lead to some sort of personalized treatment recommendation for the patient sitting in front of you, based on identifiable characteristics, something that you might consider like a phenotype or sort of a personalized approach. So we have tons of work to do, and it's a really exciting time to be in the field.
Well, again, I want to express appreciation for all that you, both you do and Dr. Edwin Kim, about helping our food allergy patients and providing the best possible care. Well, that's the end of our mini-series, Food Allergy Frontlines, Clarifying Diagnosis and Advancing Treatment. I really enjoyed hosting this three-part mini-series. If you are more interested in other episodes to explore these topics, please go to the website at college.acaai.org/allergytalk. This is Jerry Lee. I'm from the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I immensely enjoyed this conversation. Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Brian. And I hope y'all have a wonderful day.